Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, scholarship, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very pleased today to be talking with Maria Hearn, Professor of History and International Studies here at Vassar College on the Marion Musser Lloyd Chair. She's here to talk with us about the book she co-authored with Martin Klimka entitled A Breath of Freedom, The Civil Rights Struggle, African-American GIs in Germany, published in 2010 by Palgrave. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Before we start, you know, we should mention there's a film out based on the book that the Smithsonian just produced.
Right. The film was actually produced by a German company.
And
they approached me about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. They had heard about this research, and they were interested in making a film for a German audience initially, but also for German and French public television. Arte is a channel of public TV that is a cooperation between the two countries. And so as soon as we started talking, of course, they got interested also in the idea of an American audience for this film, mm-hmm. because we also, of course, this is also American history. And they reached out to Smithsonian TV production company, which is part of CBS, and mm-hmm. they were very excited about this project. So the German company actually produced the film and made it with a German director, and Smithsonian was the American partner and is now showing it in America. And in the summer, the film is coming out in Germany and in France.
Ah, great. And will it come to this area, say, upstate, or do you think, or?
Well, you know, we have shown it at Vassar, sort of
yes.
a pre-premiere
premiere. Yeah.
And it has been screened at West Point. Mm-hmm. It has been shown at the FDR Library. It's going to be shown in Schenectady a week after next. I'm going to show it at Union College. But I do think that the film is going to have much, much more. They are really reaching out to colleges. Right now, the film is being screened at a lot of high schools. It was screened for part of African American History Month. So it has been really making its way across high schools. And now they're really, Smithsonian is getting very, very eager to start showing it at colleges. So I don't know to what degree they're going to get it into movie theaters.
Yeah, it is on the internet, I found.
Right, right. And that was part of this sort of educational challenge that the Smithsonian set itself, saying, how can we use films, how can we use that kind of production of knowledge, mm-hmm. make it accessible to a wider audience? Mm-hmm. And so they made it a part of this high school competition, which is called Make Your Mark. And the idea was basically to let high school students watch the film and say, can you be inspired by what these men of the civil rights movement did, right? These World War II veterans who came home and became part of the civil rights struggle. Mm-hmm. And then high school students are supposed to sort of make some sort of a project or a little video to respond to what kind of contribution can they make in their own community. And whoever wins this will win a nice grant for their high school.
Oh, that's great.
To sort of develop educational opportunities.
Yeah, and that's the Smithsonian that's sponsoring.
Right, right.
Yeah, the Smithsonian does wonderful things
like
that, doesn't
And they
it?
Did that, of course, together with Comcast. And is, of course, in cooperation with sort of a cable company, right? But like I said, what I've seen so far, what has been done at high schools has really been quite wonderful and marvelous.
Yeah, and we'll post the URL to the YouTube site on our website at library-cafe.org so people can find it.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful if more people get to see it.
Can you talk about then how you came to write the book? What motivated you to write it?
Well, you know, my research going back to the mid-90s was on the American military in Germany. And when I was doing that research in general, I mm-hmm. came across this incredible story of black soldiers in a segregated army. Mm-hmm. And so in my first book, Jazz and Fraulein's, I addressed that in one chapter already. And what I did in that book was to show how the deployment of a segregated army forced the United States military to integrate its troops. Mm-hmm. And looking really at the top level of government, looking at the State Department and the Secretary of the Army, mm-hmm. how they were basically embarrassed by the fact that they had deployed a segregated army to Germany, and how they pushed to integrate the army, how they really pushed the Pentagon to integrate the army. But what I also realized in the story was, of course, that this was not just a story from top-down history. This was a history that was also made by people from the bottom up, that there were a lot of individual soldiers involved. In the context of that book, I couldn't do that. So I said, you know, for my next project, I'm going to spend a little bit more time. And I hadn't planned to make it a whole book about that.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be part of a larger story of sort of German and American interactions about civil rights, but also race. But then my friend Martin and I, we've been collaborating for a number of years. We were asked to put together an exhibition of photographs for a commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King and at the German Historical Institute in Washington. And so we did that, and we said, well, Martin Luther King, of course, can only be understood, or his importance in Germany, within a larger context of German occupation by America and deployment of black troops there. So we had Martin Luther King at the center, but then had all these amazing images that I had gathered over the years around African-American GIs in Germany from the 40s to the 70s. Mm-hmm. And that exhibition has been traveling for the last 4 years in Germany and Great Britain. It's now being shown again at a high school in North Carolina, but it has been shown at all the big universities in the South. It's really been very successful. And when the exhibition was about to travel, you know, somebody said to us, you should make an exhibition catalog. Mm-hmm. And so we said, oh, that's a great idea. So my friend Martin and I said, let's make a catalog. And as we started writing it, we said, you know, we have to do this right. Nobody has ever told the story. Yeah. And so it was this incredible crunch of about a year where we worked. It was very, very hard. I had, of course, gathered material over the years, and he had as well, on Angela Davis and Martin Luther King. Yeah. And so we just did sort of this major Hauruck, as we would say in Germany, right, and wrote this book to be part of that exhibition. So neither of he or I had planned to write this kind of a book, right? He was going to write a book about the leaders of civil rights and their interactions with German officials. Yeah. And so again, more of an intellectual history. And, and my plan had been to look at how the U.S. military brought civil rights concerns to Germany and how there was an interaction between just regular enlisted men and German citizens. But then we combined our efforts and produced that book.
You were partly motivated then by a sort of hole in the historical record that you felt you had to fill in.
Absolutely. That, there was a tremendous hole. You know, for me, it was a shock when I started in 91 when I went to graduate school. And, you know, when you start, you're looking for a research topic. I always tell my students, you sort of look what hasn't been done. Yeah. And I was stunned that nobody had ever written a book about the GIs themselves, right? Yeah. They were all sort of institutional histories of the military.
Yeah.
You know, there were almost 20 million GIs have been stationed in Germany.
And that's amazing to think,
amazing,
isn't it?
Amazing, since 1945.
Yeah. What is the population of the United States? Is it
300 million,
yeah,
right?
Okay, so, yeah, so.
And, you know, of those 20 million, maybe 2.5 to 3 million were African-American, right? And that history has been completely lost. And I think a big part of that is, of course, that Americans don't consider troops that deploy overseas as history. And for Germans, of course, they are foreign troops, so they're not really German history, right? So I think that is part of the reason that history sort of fell through the cracks in a way, right?
Yeah, is it also a problem of military historians not talking to social historians, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, right? I mean, military historians, and again, when I started researching, what I found was sort of histories on units, right?
Yes,
whether they had polished their buttons or something, right? So very much military efficiency concerns, or from the German perspective, studies of strategic implications of NATO and having the Americans there. But the face-to-face encounter, one of the largest cultural exchange programs to think about, right? When you think about these 20 million Americans.
Well, that's true, isn't it? When you talk about transculturation and...
How Germans were able to sort of live with the American way of life with its good sides, but also its bad sides, right?
Given how important the Second World War is in our cultural memory and how central and pervasive the issue of race is in the American historical narrative, you know, it does seem odd that we don't acknowledge the role that African Americans played in both World Wars, really, and of the effect that their service had on the dynamics of civil rights here at home. And I wonder if you have thoughts about why that is generally.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because, and again, when I was researching my first book and first discovered this history and was sort of shocked in a way, this was, of course, also the time of, you know, 95 was the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, which began the narrative of the greatest generation.
Tom Brokaw.
Tom Brokaw was
sentimentalizing World War II.
Absolutely, what others have called the emporization of World War II, right?
Yeah.
And it was always stunning for me, you know, when I would go and present papers at conferences about the military and then talk a little bit about black soldiers. There were always black veterans from World War II who now were scholars, right? And they would approach me afterwards and express this incredible, I don't want to say bitterness, that was not the right word, but the incredible hurt of having so been excluded. And one of them literally said to me, can you tell our story? Because nobody here is telling our story. And that really stuck with me. The sort of real sense that they felt that they were written out of this greatest generation. Yeah. And that was really powerful to me as a historian, because I am a social historian and I do care about making visible or audible the voices of people that nobody listened to before. Right?
Yeah.
And so initially I was a little bit ambivalent because, like I said, I'm trained as a German historian. I didn't feel like I had the expertise. I was not an African-American historian. I was not an American historian. And initially, I actually approached a colleague from graduate school who did African-American history related to the military. And I said, you know, this is great history that needs to be written. And he said to me, Maria, I don't speak German, right? Yeah. And this is, of course, a real dilemma, right? Yeah. That a lot of our American historians do not speak foreign languages unless they do German history, or French history. Yeah. So I think the history also falls through the cracks because people are just not prepared to do sort of a transnational history where you need language skills in both German and English to be able to navigate the record, the historical record.
Michelet, the French historian and a historiographer, when he writes the history of the French Revolution, talks about wanting to bring to life and do justice to the memories of the people that he finds in the French National Archives. And he talks about their dust actually being there and wanting to bring that to life.
But, I mean, that was sort of the big challenge making a film, right? Yeah. When I did a lot of work with the filmmakers, connecting them to... Yeah. Because, of course, people, filmmakers are interested in real people, right? Yeah, they don't want to use archival records.
I did watch the film myself, that's the power of the film and the people that you have on there.
Of course, I am, as the historian, I'm saying, oh my God, use this wonderful archival material that I have as well, right? The sources, Tom, for example, that I found in the American National Archives, right, were letters of complaint written by black soldiers during the occupation of Germany, right? Yeah. That we're being sent here to occupy and democratize this country, yet here we are serving in a segregated army. So that's what really moved me, thinking about the State Department didn't just do that because they thought, oh, all right, let's do the right thing. Yeah. They did it because people from below were pushing and saying, look, you're making fools of yourselves, right? By presenting yourself to the whole world as the leaders of the free world while we are being beaten up by our own white comrades, right? Because they can't stand the fact that a black man is in uniform, right? Yeah. Presented as a representative of America.
Was there ever an effort on the part of the military to sort of, to use a loaded term, whitewash the contribution that African Americans have made to the war effort in both World Wars, especially the Second World War and the Cold War also?
Yeah. I think after World War I, it was even more difficult. It was not just writing them out of history of the war.
Yeah.
They actually did everything they could to portray them as having been failures, as being weak, as being not brave, as not being smart enough to fight in a war, right? I mean, there was a real degrading of the participation of almost 400,000 African Americans served in World War I, right?
Yeah.
And when they were sent abroad, they were not sent, again, as fighters.
Yeah.
They were sent as laborers in uniform, as the Army called it. Only the 92nd and 93rd, there were two outfits that were allowed to fight. And the other one was the Harlem Hellfighters.
Yeah.
But they only served in World War I under a French commander.
Yes,
American military's officers, the officers literally refused to lead them. So after World War I in 1920s and 30s, all Army publications basically stressed the unreliability of black soldiers, and they just can't be used, right? And they were almost completely pushed out of a little military there was after that. World War II, you have the same phenomenon, right? The military not wanting to use black soldiers other than as laborers or drivers, support units. 90% of them served like that.
Which is how wars are won.
And of course, people also shoot at people in trucks bringing supplies to the front, right? But the 92nd fought in Italy, and there were some real setbacks, which was a lot of it had to do with, of course, incredibly bad leadership of white officers who were so angry that they had to lead a black battalion. You know, they said, you know, we can't use them anywhere because look what they did in Italy, right? They had incredibly bad record. And so the military did it as well in World War II, not quite as vicious as World War I, but it was clear they wanted to make as invisible as possible. For example, Army instructions were that black soldiers should never be shown in heroic postures, only as helpers or assistants, but not as heroes themselves. So there were some propaganda images were produced to keep the black population happy, so to speak, or to keep them supporting the war effort. But on the whole, the military did not want to show pictures of African-American soldiers pointing guns at you, for example.
Yeah, and most of the photos I notice you have in your archive are snapshots probably taken by soldiers themselves. They're not official photographs, most of them. So,
so we have a lot in our archive as well that are the official record, and you can really sort of see that, right? There's a couple that really try to show the harmony between white and black troops. And, of course, they did fight for a few weeks, right, in Normandy after the Battle of the Bulge. But as soon as that battle was over and that battle was won, black soldiers were put back into their black units. And I think that's sort of the other one to sort of think about for us, why that record of their participation is missing. The Army usually writes records of, you know, they have these official military histories of the infantry, the battle outfits. They don't write histories of the supply units, of the quartermasters, right? They're sort of institution history, but they're not the ones where, off, you know, soldiers make rank or where they get promoted or where heroic battles are won, and that's it.
I'm thinking of Paul Ricoeur, and he talks about the fact that archive building is a part of changing the collective memory with history, essentially, that you can use scholarship to change a memory when it doesn't work anymore. Memory is, you know, it has blind spots, to be sure. You know, some things are focused on and other things are sent to oblivion. You know, you're a historian who doesn't just work from an archive, but you're building an archive. Is that part of what you do as
Absolutely.
A historian?
I mean, there's a real sense, but, you know, Martin and I, we spend a lot of time, you know, because we have these amazing sources. Part of it started because I have these incredible sources from the 1970s, dealing with Black GIs in the 1970s and their activism with German students. And, of course, these are sort of in very private German archives from activists, right? But I have these sources, and these activists were willing to make them accessible. But these are sources that nobody in America can access unless you're a scholar of this little period or this specialty. So part of our thinking was that these are histories that nobody in America knows about. So this is a archive for other scholars who are interested in this.
Yeah.
But it's also an archive for students. You know sort of how our students here at VASS are very privileged, right? We even have a little grant in my department for students to go on research trips for their thesis. So we can give them some money. I send students to Berlin to do research. But, you know, we have many, many schools in this country that don't have that kind of privilege, right? And so part of the archive idea was also to sort of allow students from less endowed schools, be that a college with less resources or a high school, to give their students sources they could never access otherwise, right? So for me, it's not just about scholarship at the top level. It's also about how can you interest a young generation of Americans to a history that is a little bit more complex than what you see on the History Channel, right? And I find that when students discover these sources, they get very excited. And I think it's a wonderful way for a high school. We have, the, for example, a high school in North Carolina that has developed a whole curriculum around this website, right, to teach students German, but also to teach them civil rights. And so these students use this site for their research papers and presentations. And this is, to me, it's sort of an extension of what we do here at a very, again, in a position of tremendous privilege. How can we expand the knowledge we create here or that we share with our students? But also perhaps, you know, the military is stationed not just in Germany, they're in Japan and they're in Korea. You know, they were in Britain, they were in France, right? All those countries have these same histories to tell about interacting with people of color. And perhaps this archive can be sort of a kernel for a much larger transnational site where people from other countries gather these materials and put them together and create new knowledge and a new collective memory of America's involvement in the world.
Yeah, there's a lot of research to be done, isn't there, really?
Absolutely.
The United States has had at least 700 bases around the world. You know, you talk about an empire. You know, I think the British in the 19th century would have been rather amazed.
I mean, I was just teaching a class actually in American studies on that, right? The American U.S. military empire at home and abroad. And the students are always stunned when they see the scope scope of it. And of course, we are at a much lower level than we were at the height of the Cold War.
You know, you start the book with W.E.B. Du Bois, and I thought maybe we could start with him and the First World War in terms of chronology.
And we start with Du Bois because he's so amazing, because, you know, he studied in Berlin as a student. And again, you know, in the 1890s was barely a place that was not racist. There was a lot of German racism. Of course, Germany was also a colonial power, right? But what Du Bois, of course, recalls about that time is what it means to be outside of America for the first time, right? To discover and develop a completely different consciousness about who he is as a mensch. Because the big distinction in Germany was class and education rather than race in his encounter. So that as long as he was dressed in a suit and spoke eloquently, people didn't see his blackness. And that doesn't mean that there was no German racism. But there's a new book out on it, and I'm just starting to read it, actually. But it was wonderful to use him as an example of perhaps what it is like for these African-American soldiers who are leaving the South for the first time and in World War I come to France and again encounter a society that is not free from racism, but it doesn't have the sort of color line that America has. Ingrained 300-year history of vicious stereotypes and vicious hatred. And that was, of course, for those GIs, a breath of freedom. A number of scholars have worked on that the last few years to sort of show how World War I was that amazing moment as well. And you could argue that World War One was, of course, the beginning of civil rights, right? We always think about civil rights in the 50s, right? But if you look closely at the 1920s, there was tremendous activity after the war.
That's interesting, yeah.
African-American leaders were very much influenced by, you know, by Gandhi, but also all these anti-colonial movements that developed as a response to World War One, because people are saying, these people call themselves the height of civilization. Look what they just did. And also the whole notion of national self-determination, right? People in Africa and Asia said, well, this also applies to us. Right? So Versailles was, of course, also the first time where people from colonial countries showed up and said, hey, we want self-determination as well. So this, of course, also fed into this larger understanding that the American race problem is part of a larger world race problem, right? That this color line is a global color line. So I think in that sense, Du Bois is wonderful because he was the one who encouraged soldiers to go abroad, hoping that the war would bring them freedom. And then, of course, when he went abroad to visit them, he saw how terribly the military treated them, right? And he was very, very ambivalent to give that same support for World War II. And I think the other one is for us to sort of think about how that experience of freedom and democracy, of course, after World War One, was really squashed as soon as the soldiers get home. Right?
Yeah.
Tremendous violence, also related to the Red Scare, but also this because America retreats into isolationism, right?
Yes,
and the big difference after 45 is, of course, the Cold War, and that America takes on the mantle of leadership of the free world. And that really exposes the American race problem much, much more so than it did after World War One.
The Axis in the First World War wasn't driven by an ideology of racial superiority, but race, of course, did play a big part in the ideology of the Third Reich. And it seems to me, in the aftermath of that war and then going into the Cold War, that there's an inescapable logic this sets up, especially after April 45, when it becomes common consciousness of what happened in the concentration camps. And that makes civil rights reform in the United States seem a kind of logical necessity, if not actually a necessity per se.
And you could argue that we didn't even have to wait until the end of the war and the discovery of the camps to understand why World War II and America's decision to fight that war would further civil rights. As soon as the Nazis come to power, African-American civil rights activists, of course, speak up, right?
Yes,
they say, oh my God, America, why are you so upset about what is happening over there?
Yeah.
Why are you not upset what is happening to us in the South?
Yeah.
Why are you worried about stormtroopers beating up Jews when we can't be lynched in our own country, right? So that even the rise of the Nazis and the establishment of the Nazi racial state, the passing of the Nuremberg race laws that basically said Jews cannot marry Aryan Germans. Well, these were based on American miscegenation laws. And Hitler would say that to the Americans. What are you telling me here? So I think the rise of Nazism and America's determination to expose the evil of Nazism, thank God they did that, but also sort of allowed civil rights activists in the U.S. to turn the mirror on America.
But I think
what was important for the American context, too, and I think something that is often forgotten today, you know, is, of course, that because of World War II and because of the Holocaust, this crucial alliance for African-American civil rights activists were American Jews. A lot of times, Jews who had fled from Germany, many of them ended actually up teaching at traditionally African-American colleges because American anti-Semitism, they couldn't get jobs at American universities, right? Except, you know, people like Einstein, for example.
Yeah.
That was, of course, a different... But many of them ended up in the South at traditionally black colleges and became sort of an inspiration for black students there because they could talk about their own experiences and, again, sort of make these connections between black and white struggles for freedom and democracy. And I think a lot of times it's forgotten, you know, how crucial that alliance between African-American civil rights and American Jews or German-American Jews was in terms of constantly exposing the American problem of racism as just as problematic as what was happening in Germany in the 1930s. And of course, then when at the end of the war, when everybody saw the excesses of Nazi racism, where this had led, this became ever more urgent, right? And I think there was a real sense among progressive Americans, and they were not just African-Americans activists, they were also white activists who understood how shameful it was that we had such a racial division. So that the war, in many ways, shook up American certainties and allowed new alliances, right? Jewish-Christian alliances, for example, and of progressive people. Of course, there were a lot of unprogressive people who got shook up too and, you know, started digging in and said, over my dead body, so to speak. But I do think it began. It wasn't like the war was over and, oh, voila, we have civil rights.
And winning an argument doesn't mean anything's going to change. Nation states are perfectly happy to go along and being perfectly hypocritical, saying one thing and doing another. So it takes action. And the press, of course, is a big part of that. And there was a very forceful black press, wasn't there, that got involved with this and was part of this.
And the black press was absolutely essential to this, right?
Was
and
it?
I think this is also different from World War One. In World War One, you just didn't have that kind of a voice speaking for the African-American community, which was much more politicized, much more organized. And so really, really important papers like the New York and Amsterdam News, but the Pittsburgh Courier was crucial in this, Chicago Defender. Mm-hmm. And what you have, too, in World War II is that African-American press, they didn't have the kind of resources like the New York Times, but they did have fantastic war correspondents, right, who traveled to the field, who traveled to Italy and France and Germany and saw the troops and talked to them. And they could report back. But the press was also absolutely essential after 45 because they were the ones who kept going to occupation Germany and saying, oh my God, what's going on here? And they were the ones who talked to the soldiers and could then, because they could use their voice to report back to the American people, but also to sort of, you know, use their newspapers as a sort of almost screaming the outrage, you know, at white America and saying, how dare you talk about getting rid of Nazism and racism in Germany? How dare you pull down all these boundaries, their racial boundaries, and not do anything at home? How can you do that? And the press was the one that really, really talked to Truman in 48. They were instrumental in meetings.
To integrate the army.
To integrate the army, which was such a major development in terms of progress of civil rights.
So can you talk about how the civil rights movement played out in Germany among American troops and German citizens?
I think the big issue, of course, is that Germany was occupied by the Americans and re-educated, right? And as part of that re-education, the Americans spent a tremendous amount of money to bring, you know, exhibitions to Germany, speakers, you know, to build libraries, the Amerikahäuser, right, to educate Germans about the American way of life, about American democracy. Yeah. As part of that, American studies were started in Germany. Yeah. German students, high school students and college students were taken to America for exchange programs.
Yeah, I remember well, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and sort of, again, live in an American environment, go to Idaho, be at a high school, learn grassroots democracy, right? But these students, of course, when they go to America, they also discover Jim Crow, right?
Yeah.
And if they lived with a progressive family, some of the people I interviewed from my own research who were active in the 60s and 70s, they had been in America in the 50s, and their host parents would take them on civil rights marches. And this is literally, they learned grassroots democracy from the bottom up by being in an American environment. The other one was, of course, that American students would come to Germany, to German universities. Again, once black students started arriving, they, of course, brought the idea of civil rights with them as well. So you have two different things going on. On the one hand, I think you have sort of a more bourgeois, middle class, educated Germans enchantment with civil rights like Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And you have German students who they're literally physical taking their bodies to America and at American colleges and learning about civil rights and learning about passive resistance and strategies of protest and bringing that back home. So in that sense, I think there was that close connection. But at the same time, and I think this is really, really important because of the Cold War, you know, Germans talked about the race problem, but there was no way German officials could go to the army and say, this is terrible. You know, you cannot have a segregated army here. First of all, what Germany had done was so horrific. It is very difficult
for them,
to then turn the finger, right, and say, look what you guys are doing. But the other part of it is, of course, they did not want to embarrass the Americans in front of the Soviets. The Soviets used segregation and Jim Crow incessantly in their propaganda in the Cold War. So for a German official or a German politician to point their finger would have been very difficult. What German officials did, of course, they talked in private with military commanders that this is really problematic. You know, this is completely contradictory with your ideals. And if you have a segregated army here and if you have white soldiers and white officers calling black soldiers the N-word in front of Germans, and a lot of the pressure from civil rights activists they were bringing home was private conversations like that.
Yeah, and it was worse than just the N-word, though, wasn't it? I mean, there were large numbers of black soldiers being accused of rape.
But, I mean, the other one was literally physical violence, right?
Yeah.
The military police was vicious with black soldiers. A lot of time military police are Southerners, right?
Yeah,
The army was disproportionately South in this period, the officers as well.
Yeah.
Andy Rooney said, you know, he was there as a visitor in, I think, 46, 47, you know, and what observed a number of these incredible physical violent incidents where white soldiers beat up black soldiers in front of Germans and said, how are we going to teach them democracy if this is the democracy we live for them, this racial violence.
So the Soviets get any credit here? Maybe the way they did, you know, when they launched Sputnik, you have to give them credit for this surge of scientific progress.
I've not found one document that said Soviet people, thank you for what you did. But, you know, I think I am convinced, and I always say that to my students, and I think most scholars who work on Cold War civil rights would make the point that, in some sense, you can say the Cold War limited the scope of civil rights because the NAACP made a clear decision not to be too radical by 47, 48, right? And the more radical voices, like Du Bois, were sort of pushed out. We're going to work for political reform within the system. We're not going to make this an economic agenda or a social justice agenda. So in some sense, you could say the Cold War took some of the radicalism out of the civil rights movement. At the same time, because the Soviet Union was able to embarrass the Americans at this time of decolonization, right? This is not just about Germany. This is about post-45 countries and, well, you know, all these regions in Africa, colonies in Africa and Asia that had been subject to British or French rule, right, were decolonizing. Yeah. And, of course, both the Soviets and the Americans are trying to get these new countries on their side, on our team, right? And this is very difficult if American scholars before my work and before Martin's work, they have sort of looked at how did the fact that the new ambassador from a new country coming to Washington can't get a room in 1950s or early 1960s, he can't use public transportation when he visits the U.S. How did that Cold War context help create political support from people like Kennedy or Eisenhower for civil rights movement? But they mostly looked at the non-Western world. What we're trying to say is that is a wonderful thing, and we need that story. But we also need to look at how the U.S. military deployments across the globe were part of that larger Cold War debate. It was not just the non-Western world, this was also stuff in the First World that helped push forward that struggle for civility.
You were talking about the great Hearts and Minds program that took place in Germany in the 40s during the occupation. I'm curious to know, does the Civil War, the American Civil War, add a layer of historical resonance here? I mean, I sometimes think that that's where we fell down as a nation after the Civil War, and that we didn't have a similar program for the South, and things went back not to the way they had been before. We didn't have official slavery, but, you know, we had a brutal racist situation in most of the southern states and somewhat better in the northern states. And I wonder, is there a resonance here? Because there seems to be an onus on acknowledging that the civil rights movement was, in fact, a movement to essentially finish the work of the Civil War.
Just from my sort of outsider knowledge of this and sort of thinking about it, because people have written a couple of books now, you know, that's look at the occupation of Germany after 45 with the failed occupation after the Civil War. There are sort of some comparative studies, so you're onto something there, right? But it seems to me, you know, that it is, of course, much easier to sort of re-educate another country versus your own country,
right? Yeah, and
right?
times are very different.
But it seems to me that, you know, the biggest failure there, I mean, aside from the aborted mission, was that, you know, that nothing was done economically. That you cannot undo an injustice like that by just saying, well, we give everybody the right to vote. That this was a larger issue of economic equality and a failure to assure a sort of economic equality that could have leveled the playing field. So if you want to think about that again as resonance, in terms of 45, right? Yeah. The Americans were willing to put a tremendous amount of money into Germany and into Europe, right, to rebuild those countries so they would be on a more level playing field. So which really shows you that in Germany, a lot of historians, most historians, all historians, probably, the success of American democratization and rebuilding was also related to this economic miracle that became possible because Germany was not left on its feet, right? Yeah. So it just, it really boggles the mind to sort of think about what could have been done in the 1870s and 80s had some sort of a mini Marshall Plan existed, say, for African American communities in the South to give them the sort of, what do you call that, leg up, right, that Europeans were given after 45 by the Americans.
How was the desegregation of the military then? How important was it to the eventual desegregation of the South?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are two ways to look at it. Yeah. We know that a lot of the soldiers, not just who served in World War II, but also soldiers who served after, right, became veterans or activists in the civil rights movement. A lot of the soldiers who experienced the segregated army and then the desegregated army became foot soldiers of the civil rights movement. So in that sense, I think it had a huge impact in terms of the personnel, mm-hmm. people whose experiences literally made them into different human beings and made them fight for that at home. But the other one, I think that's sort of interesting because we never think about the army as a sort of a progressive institution. And I found all these articles in Germany dealing with that in the 50s, where military commanders literally are saying, oh, gee, it works. And so here we are in Germany. They're integrating installations before they're integrating them in yes. the South in America. And these commanders are literally saying, we have here sort of like a practice run, right? Mm-hmm. We can practice in Germany what we can't yet do in the South, right? Mm-hmm. Because even if we integrate a military base in the South, as soon as the soldiers come off base, yes. again in a totally segregated environment, yeah. here they're not. So we can actually learn and experience what it's like yeah. for them to be in an integrated environment on base and off base.
Right? And interestingly, this is a perfect sort of sociological model in that you have a command structure on base and then you have the life off base, and it's very similar no matter where you are, whether you're in a foreign country or whether you're home, you know, in the South where most bases were.
So I think, you know, what it helped with was convincing white commanders that this can be done, which is something they couldn't have done in the South because of, that's what they said, we can't do that in the South because of the rigid segregation there. Yeah. The other way, and I think that's something that we haven't looked at yeah. except sort of in passing, but that could be sort of a whole other research project. To what degree were white soldiers transformed by the experience of being in an integrated military,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
Because I do know that some of the images on our website, but also in the book, you have interracial friendships between black yes. and white soldiers. They're, overall, it is a segregated, right? They yeah. spend social time segregated until the 70s at least, yeah. right? But they are exceptions.
Yeah.
And I think these friendships as well, the white soldier also takes something
yes,
home,
yeah.
right? And it would be interesting to sort of think about, we know, for example, the military has much, much, much higher interracial marriage rates. Mm. And again, I think that yeah. has to do with the long history yeah. of people working together and living together. So in comparison to our civilian society, the military is much, much, much more yeah. integrated at sort of all different levels. So I would like to think that we could actually do a lot more research on, you know, how were white soldiers actually impacted by their experience yeah. of serving in the military that was much more integrated than their own society at home.
It must be something akin to a college experience for a young person at the same age going into an institution that's much larger than anything they've known before.
And, absolutely, right. Yeah. And that's why I think it's, because it is for a lot of men, it remains yeah. this incredibly formative period.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah.
for somebody who can't afford to go to college or didn't have the opportunity,
yeah.
those are the formative
yeah,
years.
Yeah.
Right?
It was, my father always spoke of it like that.
Yeah.
In terms of the civil rights movement itself, veterans like Medgar Evers, who a lot of what motivated them had to do with their experience mm-hmm. overseas, did these soldiers bring back any organizing skills having been in the military?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was really sort of a key as well, right?
Was it?
Because,
yeah.
yeah, because if they were in leadership positions, you know, mm-hmm. even as a sergeant or something, or an E5, right, or E4, you learned military discipline, right?
Yeah.
You learned how to get 10 or 15 men lined up, for example, yeah. right, or to move in a certain direction or march in a certain
yeah.
direction. So we know that a lot of veterans were part of the Civil Rights March in 1963, right,
yeah.
on the March on Washington. They were sort of essential at the march itself in helping organizing it, the logistics,
yeah.
right, but also in terms of getting people to the march from
yeah.
all sort of different communities.
And acting logically under stress is a big
exactly,
part of
it. Exactly, right, and the thing is, of course, you know, that to organize large groups of people when you know they're going to be agitators or
mm-hmm,
somebody
yeah.
who wants to disrupt it and wants to make it look bad. And I think that's where the veterans were also probably important for,
yeah.
you know, how do you remain peaceful when somebody throws ketchup at you? And the discipline that they brought with them and said, you know, you can do this, you know, even if you get humiliated like that,
yeah.
right? So they are trained in violence and trained in to be in a war, basically, but they also know that their leadership has to be not to shoot and not to
yeah,
kill, right?
Yeah.
And to encourage people in the movement to try peaceful means to do this.
Yeah. Why do you think, generally speaking, black soldiers found allies among the German civilian population more so than they did elsewhere, in Japan, for instance, or the conditions of being an American soldier in Germany, both during the occupation and afterward, different than they were in other places?
I don't want to make the statement that nothing happened in Japan,
yeah, yeah.
but no scholarship has been produced, and I don't
yes.
read Japanese. But, you know, I did this book with my colleague Song Sung-hoon in
yes.
sociology,
yeah.
where we compared Germany, Korea, and Japan, and I learned a tremendous amount by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I learned much more about Korea and Okinawa. And what was interesting to me, and that's why, and it's something we talk about in my seminar with the students right now, is what kind of a country the Americans interact with has a lot to do with what kind of a society are they interacting with,
yes.
Right? And Okinawa and Japan are very interesting because the great majority of American troops, 75%, were stationed in Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And Okinawa is, of course, a former colony of Japan,
yes.
Right? So it's like a doubly colonized country. And until 72 or 75, the U.S. occupied Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
The military commander was in charge of the whole island, not Japan. So it was a much less an environment where democracy was fostered. It remained a military occupation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so on mainland Japan, the U.S. made tremendous efforts at re-education and
mm-hmm.
democratization. But the people in Okinawa, of course, see themselves already subordinated
yes.
to the Japanese.
Yes,
they're
yeah.
seen racially as different. Japanese look down on them. So they have this double colonization, so to speak. And then on top of that, they're occupied by the Americans. So that was not conducive because educated students were in Japan. They were not in Okinawa. All these military bases are surrounded, of course, by Japanese communities. And it's much poorer than mainland Japan to
yeah.
this day. And Korea is even more extreme because Korea until the 80s was authoritarian dictatorship. And there was no civil society. So if there's no civil society, there's no possibility for American GIs to have
yeah.
partners to demand more rights in
yeah.
the military or to protest against racial discrimination. You need a counterpart. And in Germany, I think it's unique in that sense. I'm sure you could maybe show similar developments in Great Britain. I do think that the German case is different because the Germans, especially that generation that came of age after the war, right,
yeah.
they were so enthralled with America.
Yeah.
And they were so willing to look to America for leadership and for mm-hmm. guidance and for inspiration. That I do think there was much more willingness to sort of engage with soldiers, but also because of this incredible repression under the Nazis, right? These soldiers brought this jazz music and this
yeah.
American way of life,
yeah.
and so it was so intense, you know, this German-American alliance and exchange.
Was the length of the average stay different in Germany than it was elsewhere?
Right,
for
and that also makes a difference, right?
Yeah.
In Germany, usually they stayed 3 years. In Japan, they stayed longer as well, but in Korea, only 1 year. Soldiers went there without families, so
yeah.
it was just a very different sort of social. Mm. The landscape of interaction was very, very different. In Korea, it was mostly along the lines of prostitution, the interaction with the civilian population.
Can you talk about the racial crisis in the Seventh Army in Germany during
yeah.
the Vietnam War and that sort of later period of the civil rights movement
yeah.
that I remember,
we
60s
and
the
70s?
We both remember.
We
both remember. Yeah, Angela Davis
yeah.
very much so.
Yeah.
You know, we had a
yeah.
poster of Angela up on my dorm bedroom, along with Karl
yeah.
Marx and Trotsky.
Well, you know, the interaction between GIs and Germans had, of course, all these different stages, and the 70s, of course, was a tremendous turning point.
Yeah.
Because opposition to the war in Vietnam and Germany, right? So beginning in the 60s, students and Germans sort of stood back a little bit from the soldiers and said,
yeah.
oh my God, here you are, and it's incredibly unjust war, and you're
yeah.
killing women and children, and what
yeah.
are you doing?
Yeah.
Our former heroes have turned
yeah.
into killers.
Yeah.
So tremendous disenchantment.
Yeah.
And
Germany was a kind of decompression stop for soldiers coming out of Vietnam, wasn't it?
A lot of yeah. And then the big issue in Germany was, of course, that the military used the 7th Army in Germany. There were 250,000 men in Germany
mm-hmm.
between the 7th Army and the Air Force. But they used the 7th Army as a supply base for materiel and personnel,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the units in Germany completely deteriorated, right?
Yeah.
They didn't have any real leadership. Officers rotated every 3 or 4 months. There was, of course, tremendous frustration among the troops over the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
They knew they would be deployed from there to go to Vietnam.
Yeah. And most troops were draftees.
They were draftees,
was,
right? It was not
yeah.
a volunteer army,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And, of course, because of the war, there's also this growing drug problem in the military, right? Tremendous problems with marijuana and heroin at
yeah.
this time. But the big problem was the racial
yeah.
crisis, right? I mean, I think there was a real sense among African-American GIs that they died disproportionately.
Yeah.
And this crisis really came to a head after the murder of Martin Luther King in
68, yeah.
when there was a real sense that, you know, that the peaceful, good civil rights movement had died, and it's just time for more radical action, right? This
yeah.
country is just not going to change. And so with the rise of Black Power, which was, of course, before Martin Luther King's death, that really shifted. You can really see it among Black soldiers. I was a teenager at the time, and I remember very vividly still all of a sudden these very different African-American soldiers, you know, walking in my little village with berets and black jackets and, you know, doing the power salute and doing the dabbing, you know, and we were, of course, completely fascinated by this. What is this? What is that? And, you know, we're reading about what is going on in America, right? But again, to sort of see it lived out in your neighborhood was very interesting. So the military in Germany, the 7th Army, was literally close to collapse, right? And what the crisis really revealed, because there was tremendous amount of insubordination, there were fraggings in Germany, where soldiers threw grenades in commanders' offices. I remember one incident in my little hometown where the soldiers put a big speaker in the window of a barracks, right, and they had a general coming, and they're standing there to attention, and as he starts to march by, you know, Country Joe and the Fishers, give me an F, give me a U, give me K, right? And then the whole cloud, they roared, what's that spelled, you know? And that's how bad it was, you know? And there was also, because of that, the Pentagon and the White House sent investigations to Germany, but also to the biggest trouble spots where Vietnam itself and Germany, right, in terms of the racial violence, but also the racial anger. And the one in Germany was just so aggravated because they had a lot of German supporters, right, the black soldiers. And they gave them a voice they wouldn't have otherwise had, you know.
And was there beef mainly with the army, or was it just generally civil rights in the States?
I think a number of things come together. Of course, they live discrimination in America, right? And then they're being sent to another country whose language they don't speak, if they're lucky, and end up in Germany rather than in Vietnam. Yeah. And being prepared to go and kill other people of color. And I think there's a real thing. I mean, God, I'm in the military. The military is, of course, integrated at this point. But the racism in the military is still there. It was institutionally, it had changed. It is integrated. But as we all know, changing laws and changing hearts and minds is a different thing. So there was tremendous continuing institutional racism in the military, which came out in ways that was not ordered from the top, but that black soldiers had a lot more Article 15s, right? These are punishments for infractions. Yeah. And if you have two or three Article 15s, they can kick you out.
Yeah.
And then you have
dishonorable discharge,
right?
Yeah.
And then your life is basically over.
In those days, it was like having a prison record.
And also the number of African-Americans in prison, in what they call pre-trial confinement, which commanders can do according to military law, right? If a black soldier was seen as uppity or too militant, they would put him in jail. So there's the NAACP, they came as well, right? They did this investigation and found incredible institution-wide discrimination. And they wrote these reports they were hearing before Congress. And as a result of that, there was really tremendous reform within the military. Now, if you look very closely, I looked at 600 interviews with black soldiers from that period. The NAACP interviewed a lot of soldiers. Some of them were, of course, really committed, ideological. They had had some college, perhaps, and they sort of believed in tying internal, being a colony in America, to sort of a larger colonial liberation movement in the non-Western world, to sort of see themselves, again, lined up with German students and doing that. But I would say the great majority of these soldiers had very simple concerns, like discrimination, you know, a racist sergeant. Also really something we can't even imagine today, right? There were no products for hair in the stores, right? No makeup for black women in the commissary. Yeah. No black history, of course, in the Department of Defense schools. They had some black chaplains, but no black judges, for example. In the, you know, I think at the time there were four black generals in the whole army. And so there was a real sense, you know, we're not being represented. Yeah. You know, all publications of the military showed white faces. Every Stars and Stripes story on problems said black soldier, right? When there was a problem. But they never said a white soldier when it was a problem, right? Yeah. Or, you know what I mean? It was the sort of really sense that they were invisible in the military, except when it came to problem, then they were disproportionately represented. So I think their willingness to really be incredibly militant and to also align with German student radicals provoked a crisis in the military, but also within the German government, because they said, my God, we can't be perceived as a country where black soldiers feel unwelcome, right? Because then they go off base, and of course, German bars and restaurants at that point, they're not just closing their bars to black soldiers, they're closing it to white soldiers because there's incredible violence between them, right? Yeah. I don't want them to beat up, you know, to beat up my interior.
Yeah,
here, right?
Brawls,
So you have a certain level of racism in Germany. Yeah. German landlords, is it? if I rent to a black soldier, no white soldier will rent with me, right? Mm-hmm. So this, all this stuff comes together, right? So here are these black men and their wives, and say, my God, I'm in a foreign country fighting for democracy to defend these Germans, and I can't move into an apartment. And that really boiled over. And I think I have this long conversation with my colleagues at West Point about that, because I have a colleague there who works on the protests of black cadets in the 70s,
yeah,
right?
Oh.
And we both really agree that without that militant stance of both the cadets in the 70s and my soldiers in Germany,
yeah,
in the 70s, the military would have not changed.
Oh,
right?
That's interesting.
These reforms were really made possible because there was this incredible sense of urgency because, yeah, again, it was sort of like, if the 7th Army in Germany falls, right,
yeah,
that this is the heart,
yes,
of the,
yeah,
defense,
yeah,
against
the free Soviets, world, yes.
The free world,
the free,
right?
World, yes.
But right, I mean,
the
350 1,000 Russians are,
yeah,
just,
yeah,
you know, a few miles away on the other side. We can't let this army collapse. And so there was a tremendous effort when a new commander was brought in, General Davis, who was really fabulous and sort of really beefing up the command structure, but also listening to black soldiers, listening to them about Afro hair and,
yeah,
and what can we do to allow them,
yeah,
to have their Afro without,
yeah,
falling outside of military regulations,
yeah,
and that sort of thing.
The type of history that you're doing here, you know, gathering eyewitness testimony to events in part, is very different from the type of work that most historians do, which often involves working in archives from accounts long, mm-hmm, after the fact. And in the case of most historians, this is often centuries, and some, if you're a Roman historian, millennia after the fact. Has this kind of double involvement, on the one hand with the wider historical narrative, and on the other with its actors, actually, and their particular narratives, left you with any insights into the writing of history per se?
If you do Zeitgeschichte, as we call,
mm-hmm,
it, right,
yeah,
the kind of history that I do, I don't think there is that sense anymore that you have to wait 30 or 40 or 50,
yes,
years to access a record. Of course, a lot of times you have to, because, you know, even with me, the records for the 50s, I had a lot of stuff declassified under Freedom of Information Act, and,
yeah,
stuff from the 70s is almost impossible to come by, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of very, very difficult still. So there is a natural, you have to wait for something. But I think historians have for a long time, the kind who do that kind of history that I do, right?
Yeah.
To also use oral histories.
Yeah.
I mean, especially in Germany, right, with the innovation of Alltagsgeschichte, the,
mm-hmm,
history of everyday life, right? You cannot tell that. And which was really important for Nazi Germany. What was it actually like,
well,
to live under a dictatorship?
Yeah.
Right?
And even medieval historians, that's what many are trying to reconstruct now. What,
right,
was it like,
right,
like for the ordinary,
right,
person?
Right, but
so,
I'm just saying,
yeah,
is that historians, since, I would say, in Sozialgeschichte, so,
yeah,
social history, and Alltagsgeschichte, since the 60s, 70s, have started to talk to people, to interview them, that these sources are not two different poles, but they really come together. I mean, you have to be careful, of course, but I have to give you this as an example. People can be leery about oral history, and they say, well, how reliable is memory? And you, of course, have to incredibly be careful with that. But I only discovered that the military was in Germany in 1950-51 with segregated troops because of oral history. I was talking to,
oh,
Germans, saying to them, how was it when the Americans came? So I just,
yes,
started my interview like that. And they talk about it, and then they would, you know, they never talked about black soldiers. So it just,
yeah,
never came up, maybe because black soldiers have been there for so long,
yeah,
right? It was not unusual. But then I would say, well, how was it when black soldiers came? That must have been weird for you. You never had seen black people before. And they would say, yeah, that was interesting, you know, when they came with those Negro units. And,
yeah,
I said, what do you mean, Negro units? I said, the army was integrated in 48. They said, no. So I said, oh, God, there you go. How unreliable are these social histories,
yeah,
right? Or these oral histories.
Yeah.
And then I heard it again and again. And then,
yeah,
I realized it wasn't integrated, right? They were,
yeah,
there with segregated units. So I literally discovered this story in 1992 because of what I considered were faulty memories, right? But, of course, to them, that was what had stood out, right?
Yeah.
That they were in separate segregated,
yeah,
units.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And they used the term that the Americans used, Negro units, right?
Yeah.
Negereinheiten,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That was a German term, right? So, but on the whole time, I would say, it is in my field, and I know in American history,
yeah,
too, you desperately look for these voices,
yes,
to,
yeah,
get them in,
yeah,
there, right?
Yeah.
Because, again, you know, they are often so diffused in the bureaucratic,
yeah,
record. I mean, like I said, I've been working on this for 10 years to recover the sources I have because it's not one big folder at the National Archive. Things dealing with black,
yes,
soldiers,
yes, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Martin and I, we have worked together where we spend a whole week, you know, and maybe every day we found two documents,
yeah,
you know, and spend all day going through thousands of pages,
yeah,
quickly,
yeah,
scanning, because if a country doesn't think that somebody's history is important, the record is going to be thin, right? Yeah. And there's usually only a record of when there was trouble. And so a lot of the military records pertaining to black soldiers have to do when there was trouble. And that's, of course, a very biased record as well. So I think if you do it smart, you have to be smart about oral histories. Yeah. You have to weigh them against the other evidence you have. Right?
Does it make you suspicious of history generally? The human experience so often contradicts the official record.
Well, I think you have to be because historical records are not
the
objective. Truth. I mean, and again, as a German historian, my God, learn the Nazi records. Of course you can't trust what they're saying here, right? Yeah. So how do you find truth or the an approximation, perhaps, of truth? But military records, even in a democracy, they're obfuscating, right?
Yes,
I mean, they're not truth. They tell a particular story. These reports by military commanders to their higher-ups, fine here, we're good.
Everything's fine.
All the buttons are polished, right? It's not as if there's an objective record and this is the one and we just put in a couple of oral histories, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's why this is such an interesting topic to me to this day, is the sort of how do you write a history when none of the sources are gathered anywhere, right? You are like a Sherlock Holmes, I tell my students. And that's why I love working on this with my students, because I have sometimes students help me. I've used classes to help get students to, for example, interview some of these veterans, right? Or to gather these sources, to make students realize that the writing of history is not finished. It's something that's an ongoing process, and that's a very creative process, and how they can be part of that, and how it can be also a democratic process, in the sense of giving voice to people who didn't have a voice before.
It must give you a sense, too, talking to real people. It must be moving, for one thing, talking to people who've experienced events that percolate up into a collective memory. You must have a sense, I would guess, that no matter how accurate the history, that there's something of that that gets left out.
Well, I think you can read, you know, all the sources you want, right? And then you have these amazing moments when you talk to somebody, right? And
they come through in the film, I have to say, a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, right?
Yeah.
And I said, if you look at the other videos we have on our website, right? You know, there was some when I was in tears, or my student who was with me was in tears, you know, when that person talked about specific degradations they were put through, you know. But there was one, you know, early in the 90s when I was still working on GIs and Fraulein's, I found out that the newly appointed director of Interpol was a child of an African-American GI and a German woman, and who got married in 47. And they came to the States in the early 50s, I guess. And, you know, I was just brash. And I just emailed him and said, oh, congratulations on your appointment. Would you be willing to share some of your recollections, you know? And one of the stories he sent to me, it was so moving to me, is when they left Germany to go back to the U.S. And they were, the first thing they did is let their segregated his parents on the ship. So he had to stay with his dad because he was considered black and his mother had to go into the white section. And then he also talked about how difficult it was for them in the United States to travel because there were no hotels that took interracial couples. And so for him as a child, the pain of when they traveled, of his mom leaving and going to another hotel. And of course, he as a child, he didn't understand why his mom left him. And to hear that psychological pain, that's something you can't find anywhere else, right? It sort of helps you to empathize with people, right? It helps you understand the story, I think, on a different level. To hear that fear of a little child versus, you know, somebody reflecting, you know, I'm 18-year-old, I'm a soldier, I'm fighting, and I'm being discriminated against, right? And it really showed me sort of how profound it influenced all aspects of life and what a struggle it must have been for these couples. And I know that a lot of the couples I interviewed who are interracial couples, and some of the stories they shared, you know, this incredible struggle they had, not just in the U.S., but also in Germany, where people looked at interracial couples with sort of a dismay, you know, like, oh, did you have to get married, and now you have a child? And, you know, it gave me tremendous respect for people who, in the 40s, were that brave.
Yeah,
right?
The strength.
To say, I love this man, and I want to be with this man, and or vice versa, right? For him, it was probably very difficult, too, to bring home a white wife, to also be told, well, you can never visit your parents again in the South, right?
And then, you know, you're putting your spouse through this. You know,
but also to say to your parents, you know, I will never be able to come to the South again because my government does not allow me with a white woman, right? The military learned that, right? When they sent black soldiers back with white women, they were arrested if they came to military base in the South. So, you know, you learn to respect people for how brave they were, you know, when you interview people. Yeah. Not all people, of course, right?
But
you have these incredibly moving moments, and they I do think they help us become better writers of history because they teach us empathy, and I think you need empathy to write a good history.
That's very interesting. So I want to thank you, Maria, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, A Breath of Freedom, The Civil Rights Struggle, African-American GIs in Germany.
Thank you for the opportunity to share this story, because I think it's an important one that all too many Americans and Germans don't know about. And I think it's about time that we learn more about sort of the transnational implications, you know, of American history and German history.
It was an eye-opener for me. So thank you again.
All right. Good. Okay.